I'd like to acknowledge that I'm filling some very, very large shoes. Our teacher, Shyla, who's normally the person that's teaching, is somebody who's an extraordinary Buddhist teacher. And those of you that have never met her, I really encourage you to come back after April 20th. Is that when she's back? And avail yourself of somebody who is both gifted as a teacher, but also very personable, and somebody who really makes this Sangha very alive. I thought, rather than having me just start talking at you, that my preference would be to get you to talk a little bit to each other and to warm the room up a little bit. So here's the subject that I'd like you to talk about for a few minutes. What does the phrase, "you can never get enough of what you don't really need," mean to you? So pick somebody that you don't know and take turns. I'll let you know when we're about midway by hitting the bell. So you'll have about 2 minutes per person. Okay, go. Switch. Make sure the other person talks. How are you going to get them back to the farm once they've seen Gay Puri, right? Start talking and, God, so much to say about that subject. So just in terms of the structure of the evening, I plan on talking for about 30 minutes, and then we'll open it up for reactions, questions, comments, and we'll end at 9. Okay? This subject is one that I come to through the School of Hard Knocks. So at 20 years old, I was 300 pounds, smoking 3 packs of cigarettes a day, all surreptitiously. I always smoked so that my first wife didn't know, because I felt guilty and ashamed that I was doing it, but somehow I was able to get 3 packs in before the end of the day. Drinking alcohol abusively and smoking marijuana on a daily basis. If somebody would have asked me why I was doing that instead of talking at me and telling me what I should be doing, I would have said, the only thing I really know is that it feels good. And then if I had maybe gone below that, if I'd been capable of going below that answer, the next answer I might have given is that there's something inside of me that hurts so bad that I have to be doing all of that. I had the good fortune of having a close friend that I was working with in a residence camp, a summer camp for kids. And over the course of the summer, I got a chance to observe him every single day, 18, 20 hours a day, because we worked together in this, you know, you couldn't escape from Camp Tawanga. Once you were in Camp Tawanga, you could not get out of Camp Tawanga. That's where you were, except for times when you went to Camp Mather. So I got a chance to watch this man all summer, and he had just spent 2 years meditating and learning yoga and eating a vegetarian diet. These were all things that were completely and absolutely foreign to me. I mean, I had been raised as a Jew. I had just finished graduate school in social work in New York. You know, I was trained as an analytical therapist. you know, somebody who asked a lot of whys. And here was this person who, by his presence, really inspired me to ask, what was he doing that was so compelling to watch? Because he really had a presence about him. And I watched him in conflicts. I watched him in situations where I would have really spun out of control. And he seemed to have a way, kind of a presence of mind in dealing with things. That was my first exposure to meditation. And at the end of the summer, he encouraged me and cajoled me and wheedled and eventually got me to do a 3-day meditation retreat. And during that retreat, my life transformed. I spent 3 days asking the question, who am I? And for the first time in my life, honestly answering the question. It took about a day and a half to get beyond the point of trying to put up a good show and impress the cute girls that were there. But after about a day and a half, I ran out of the steam of the ego to be able to keep on, you know, mocking up some kind of attractive person, and eventually began to really speak from that question, who am I? And as I peeled away layers of the onion, I began to tell the truth about some of these behaviors that nobody really knew about, including the compulsive eating, including the drinking. And as a direct result of that 3-day experience, I never picked up another cigarette. In fact, I didn't remember that I was a smoker until about 3 weeks later. I mean, I'm serious about that. I just remember waking up one morning about 3 weeks later and remembering that I used to smoke. That was the power of meditation. That was the power of transformation. A year after the retreat, I began to think about the fact that I no longer had to eat the way that I was eating, and I went on a pretty rigorous, I don't know what you'd call it, it was an apple fast. You know, basically, I did something that at 21 you can get away with. I wouldn't recommend it to anybody over 30. I lost a lot of my hair. I used to have a full head of hair. But at the end of it, I had lost 100 pounds. And as many of you know, it's not about the weight loss. It's really about, well, how do you maintain that? You know, how do you deal with it on a daily basis? About 2 years later, 2 or 3 years later, I was looking for work, and I ended up getting hooked up with a man who was starting an inpatient alcoholism program at Sequoia Hospital that was doing something very innovative. He was taking the 12-step programs and meditation practice, and he was very close to Werner Erhard and the EST organization, and he was incorporating the EST philosophy or methodology in this recovering alcoholism program. Very powerful experience for the people who went through the program. It was more powerful, I think, for the staff in a way, because we had to be always exemplars. So we couldn't really let down on our recovery where, you know, other people had that option. They could relapse. It wasn't really an option for us. I was the only non-recovering person on the staff. Within the first year, I found out 3 things. One was that my father had been an alcoholic, that my family was riddled with addiction, that if I look back at a multi-generational map of my family, I could go back at least 3 generations and see obesity, alcoholism, cigarette smoking. If you include relationship addiction, there was a lot of people in the family who sold their soul to be in very bad relationships. And so it began to get personal. Instead of me going to AA meetings as if I were a visitor to a planet I didn't really understand, I was now there as an adult child of an alcoholic. And then also one of the recovering alcoholics who noticed that I was going to all these AA meetings, said to me, have you ever heard of Overeaters Anonymous? And I had never heard of OA. She said, it's for us. And she explained what she meant by us. And I went to my first OA meeting and found that this was exactly the right place for me. Because even though I'd lost 100 pounds and I had kept it off now for several years, the what is called stinking thinking, the thinking disorder of the addict was very much alive and well. It had transferred itself from substances like food or alcohol or marijuana, and it had moved on to, as some people would say, taking hostages, not having relationships. I never had a healthy relationship without recovery, without some kind of transformational process. And in the recovery facility that I was working in, one of the things that we did was we were teaching a form of mindfulness-based stress reduction. So I was encouraging recovering alcoholics to learn how to track their breath, to begin to notice the sensations that were going on in their body so that they'd have early warning signs to begin to notice the beginning of a relapse. Noticing emotions that were dangerous to the recovery process. Somebody might say, well, they would notice that when they felt a lot of anger or that they noticed a pattern of beginning to feel irritable a lot, that often led to the next step, which would be to justify their feeling that way and leading themselves into resentment and then leading themselves into relapse. And so even though at that time, 1972, 1973, there really wasn't a term called mindfulness-based stress reduction, at least that I was aware of, I was finding myself kind of in the middle of several people who were trying to bring what I later learned was Vipassana Buddhism. Having been introduced to Buddhism at 17 by Alan Watts, I lived three houseboats away from Alan Watts in Kappus Yacht Harbor in Sausalito. And every Thursday night he would get very drunk and then rant on Hinduism, Buddhism, whatever the flavor of the week was, and give brilliant, absolutely stunningly brilliant talks while at the same time completely soused. But that was my first introduction to Buddhism, reading his book, The Taboo Against Knowing Who You Are. And between 20 and 24, I had the good fortune of coming in contact with His Holiness the Dalai Lama and with the Karmapa, the 13th Karmapa. I felt a very strong attraction to Tibetan Buddhism. I realize now that a lot of it is because I love ritual. Having grown up in a Jewish family and conducting Seder and being a part of those rituals was very important to me. And Tibetan Buddhism had enough ritual, it had enough salvation that it promised, that it reminded me a lot of Judeo-Christian thought. Let me just take a pause for a second here. I think the thing that drew me to Buddhism is the same reason why at 63 I continue to practice. And so I've been practicing some form of Buddhism for almost 40 years, not in any way the disciplined manner that I do today. I've been a dabbler a lot of my life, kind of trying this, trying that, when it got too hard, doing something else. But I have a pretty serious practice now, and the reason that I got started in my 20s and the reason that I've continued is because the Buddha spoke to me about my condition. I'm a psychologist. I consider psychology to be one of the most important ways that I understand the world. And Buddhist psychology in particular is extraordinarily useful to me as a human being And I find that as a psychotherapist or as a consultant in organizations, that it's something that I can immediately apply to any situation. So let me give you an example of what I'm talking about. I was sitting with a colleague who was a recovering alcoholic, and we were talking about the root cause of addiction. You know, I think anybody who's worked in the field has a lot of theories and ideas about why we're addicted. You know, what is addiction and why are we addicted? And one of the first things that really drew me to Buddhism was the notion that there are these characteristics of the human mind that we all share. And as the Dalai Lama says, ultimately the thing that we share most with all of us is that we all want to be happy. And unfortunately, for those of us who are short-term thinkers, who have a hard time seeing beyond how this will affect us right now, drugs, alcohol, food, sex, rock and roll are all very pleasurable and make you happy. And so I thought, well, I was just doing what the Dalai Lama said. I was just trying to be happy. Well, it just so happens that what I was also doing was I was stoking the fire of desire, which is another of these human characteristics of the mind. The human mind has these ways in which it functions that are just built in. They're hardwired. There's nothing that we can do about it. The only thing that we can do about it is that we can understand it, recognize it, develop some objectivity about it, and then begin to choose to do something different. And being a very practical person and somebody who is always asking the question, how does this apply to my helping myself and helping my clients or helping my friends, I found that Buddhism answered questions that I couldn't find in Judaism and hadn't found anywhere else. So an example of that is that my observation as a psychotherapist is that that people suffer, that an example is that the experience of suffering doesn't miss anyone. You know, if you think about great spiritual or religious leaders, they also have historically had their share of addiction. For example, a very, very well-known Indian guru who my wife and I followed for several years, who was a diabetic, was found with Coke cans and candy bars after he died all over his ashram that he'd hidden. His swamis, who were celibate, were involved with underage girls. Roshi Baker, Dick Baker, the Zen Center, ended up discharging taking off the robes because of his inability to deal with romantic love. And I'm not saying this to be critical of anyone. I'm only pointing out that anyone is prone to desire. Anybody is prone to ignorance and delusion. And anybody can make mistakes based upon how the mind works. And so I began to start thinking about, well, you know, is addiction something that you could apply a Buddhist psychological perspective to? And if you did, how would you do that? And one of the things that I noticed about myself, and I don't think this is uncommon, is that most human beings have wonderful avoidance skills at not dealing with certain life realities. And the Buddha named them. You know, he said, look, this is what's going to happen. You're going to age. And so here we are in the midst of a culture that is dedicated to youth. And aging is not something that as a civilization, as a culture that we're very comfortable with. And so it's very easy to deny that inevitability and to find yourself addicted to those things that allow you to be able to ignore or at least to mask the this fact. We're all going to get sick. You know, even those of us who have dedicated our lives to aerobic exercise and yoga, and we still get the colds, we still get flus, we're still going to experience the degenerative process of aging. And if you're not comfortable with dealing with sickness, if you're not comfortable with dealing with the symptoms, the physicality of your body getting sick, then you're going to try to avoid that. And the ways that we avoid it, unfortunately, are multitudinous in this culture. We have so many choices of ways to not deal with reality. I mean, I personally feel tremendous discomfort with watching the way that people look at screens. You know, I've been interested in addiction for almost 30 plus years, and so I've got a historical reference in terms of how addiction has kind of shown up in America. And I remember in 1975, Ann Wilson Schaaf. I don't know if any of you have ever read Ann Wilson Schaaf. She wrote a book called "Are We a Nation of Addicts?" And the book was dedicated to trying to bring to consciousness the underbelly of America. The fact that we have so many choices and that we are constantly being marketed to about do this, buy this, have this. And if you don't think that your mind is a piece of real estate that the advertising and marketing industry would love to own, you know, all you have to do is just watch from the observer perspective what's being said to you, what you're hearing. I remember when my oldest daughter, Sarah, is 27. When she was 7 years old, she had never watched commercial TV. We'd never had commercial TV in our home. And so she was now in like first grade or something like that. And of course, at this point, she's starting to go to other people's houses for play dates, and she's coming back and she's saying, "I want to watch." And so my wife and I were in a crisis. You know, here we had this value that we didn't really want her watching crummy TV, but at the same time she was being exposed to it. So what were we going to do? And my wife came up with a terrific idea. She said, "Sarah, you can watch TV as long as one of us are in the room. And what we're going to do is we're going to ask you questions during the commercials." So the commercials would come on, and it would be for Barbie or G.I. Joe or whatever. And we had one or two questions that we asked repetitively. One was, "What are they asking you to do, Sarah? What do they want you to do?" And then the second thing that we'd ask is, "What's your reaction? How do you feel right now while you're watching this?" And within a month, she'd figured out that they were constantly trying to sell her something, and that if she didn't buy it, she'd feel bad about herself. So how often do we watch TV? How often do we get on the computer? How often do we check our BlackBerry? And notice what it's doing to us. You know, I'm not suggesting that one becomes a Luddite and basically stops using these things, but it's important to be conscious, because it's very easy to become addicted to that kind of instant gratification of somebody is always talking to you. They love you. The marketing people absolutely love you. Yeah. So I thought one thing I ought to do is to clarify what I mean by addiction, because I've seen all too frequently people using the term without defining it. And so what I'd like to do is to define it for you behaviorally rather than in a clinical or medical way. So there are five factors that make up an addiction. So if you don't have these five factors, then you don't have an addiction. You might have a compulsion. You might have an obsession. You might experience withdrawal from time to time, but the five factors have to go together for it to be an addiction. Okay? Okay. Now, I didn't mean to stoke your denial. So the first is that addiction is characterized by physical compulsion. And the physical compulsion is to do something that has demonstrably shown itself to be harmful to you. So, for example, something as innocuous as sugar, if you know that when you take in sugar that it makes you crabby or that you want more or that you gain weight, those are physical harming practices. So for you, that may be a compulsion. Sugar could potentially be a compulsion. The second factor is a mental obsession. So one of the characteristics of addiction is that your mind tends to keep coming back to the object that you're addicted to. You know, you find yourself several times per hour thinking about whatever it is that you happen to be obsessed by. To clarify, one can be addicted to substances, which we all know about, food, you know, blah, blah, blah. But you can also be addicted to processes. So my observation is that we live in a culture that's addicted to work. And that one of the characteristics of the addiction to work is that rather than being able to go home and to appreciate the loving people who were there, you're checking your BlackBerry to see if your boss wants you, or you're making sure that the stock price is up, or that you're thinking anxiously, constantly about the next business opportunity. That's an obsession. You know, the contrast is being able to be present with something that is right in front of you and giving it your full attention as compared to constantly being pulled away from that. The third factor is that addiction is emotionally harmful to yourself and others. So one way that addiction shows itself is that it destroys self-esteem. There's a statement that you often hear in the 12-step programs that people who are addicted can't consistently tell the truth to themselves or others about what they're going to do. So, for example, you can make a New Year's resolution that you're going to lose 15 pounds and then find yourself in February gain 5. And that if you look at what the root cause of that is that there's a way that you relate to food that is emotionally toxic that is causing harm to your ability to tell the truth and say, I will do something and keep your word. And of course, if you look at it from, you know, the perspective of, I have clients who are in marriages where they say over and over again every Friday night, I promise that on Monday I'll come home at the time I said I would come home. Oh, honey, I'm so sorry. I'm still at the office. It's 2 hours late. Oh, the kid had a baseball game. I said I'd be at the baseball game. Tough luck. I'll make Thursday. See, that's emotionally harmful to yourself and others. The fourth characteristic is that it's progressive, meaning that what at one point you could do without and that you could let go easily, over time you find yourself becoming harder and harder to put that aside. And then the last one is that there's withdrawal symptoms when you're not practicing it. So withdrawal symptoms can be something as simple as feeling some sense of irritability, that when you do it again, you feel better for some short period of time. Withdrawal can be physical, a physical sense of nausea or headaches. You know, people describe that when they stop eating sugar or they stop drinking coffee, that they often feel headachy. So consider all five. The reason why I particularly like Buddhist psychology is because this is the standard that it sets. The standard is that human beings are noble by birth, that our birthright is to be relaxed, our birthright is to be truthful, our birthright is to be whole, our birthright is to be kind and compassionate, our birthright is to be conscious and aware, and that anything that deadens those characteristics or qualities is harmful. They may not be an addiction, but they're certainly harmful. And we live in the midst of a milieu that is so oriented towards consumption that it's very, very difficult, very, very difficult to be a sober, moderate, healthy person. It takes an act of intentionality and awareness to, first of all, realize how much you're being marketed to or kind of talked to about what you should be doing with your time and energy and resources, and then to begin to pull away from that and to consciously pull away from it. So the last thing I'd like to say before opening this up for reactions, comments, and questions is that I personally have found in Buddhism three keys to both addiction and any other desire to be mentally healthy. And so I'd like to offer those to you and give a little bit of an example with each one. So what I believe the three keys are to mental health or to nobility of being are, first of all, mindfulness. The National Institute of Health named mindfulness-based stress reduction as the most promising non-interventive medical approach for the coming decade. The NIH, I don't know if they actually funded it because of the current economic crisis, but at one point early last year, they'd allocated $50 million to study the effect of mindfulness on a broad spectrum of illnesses, ranging from cancer to pain reduction to, you name it, mindfulness works with it. So those of you that are regular practitioners of Vipassana or insight meditation have done mindfulness-based stress reduction, if you do it on a regular basis, it's applicable to any situation at all where you have to deal with something that's hard, or just for that matter, to deal with daily life. So mindfulness is the first. The second is something that Shaila, our teacher here, has introduced to this Sangha, which is called Samadhi or Jhana practice, which is concentration. And having done a couple of retreats, a couple of Jhana retreats, I can say that one of the things that I've seen is that mindfulness plus concentration practice is an extraordinary, powerful combination, because not only are you able to learn how to track moment by moment the changing states that are going on inside and outside of you, but with concentration practice, you're able to do something which many of us find difficult, which is to redirect our attention away from something unwholesome to something wholesome. So the power of concentration for me, and I know that there are many other things that one could say about concentration practice, but the thing that has been most helpful to me is that I notice how much easier it is for me to observe something that is a mental pattern that is unwholesome, that's not going to lead me where I want to be, and to observe it and bring my mind somewhere else that is wholesome, whether it's to the breath or whether it's to loving kindness practice or whether it's just simply to get involved in something that is beneficial. And then the third comes directly out of my effort to try to work with people who have weight-related illnesses. So because it's something near and dear to my heart, I've spent most of my career working with people who have weight-related illnesses and have never been satisfied with the impact that I'm making. Basically, it's extremely difficult for people who have that problem, my problem, to sustain a long period of abstinence or healthy eating. And what I've learned is that without altruism, without learning to turn your attention away from your own self and to offer your kindness to others through some form of altruism, that you don't stand a prayer of being able to recover fully. Now, anybody who's a recovering alcoholic or a recovering drug addict or anybody in any 12-step program would tell you that their sobriety rests upon carrying the message to people who are suffering. And I would take that one step further and to say that for anybody who's trying to cultivate wholesome states of mind, that any practice of generosity, and particularly for people who I treat, what I recommend is that instead of compulsively spending that money on that scone or that dessert or that extra bit of food, that you donate it to Heifer International or you donate it to a food bank. And just see how it feels to turn your desire into compassion for others. It's an incredibly powerful experience. And you don't have to be in a position where you're trying to deal with an addiction to see the power of that. I think anybody who's found themselves spending too much money on things that they don't really need can benefit from taking some percentage of that and putting it towards something that you really believe in and seeing how that affects your self-esteem. So I'd like to say that's all I have to say. I'd like to open it up. Please feel free to react, respond, question. So the floor is open. Anybody would like to, and if you would just raise your hand and speak loudly, okay? Yes, please.
Can you repeat the
5 characteristics? Sure. Those 5 factors. Yes. So quickly, physical compulsion, mental obsession, emotional harm to self or others, progressive, keeps getting worse, and withdrawal. Thank you.
We were talking about...
Make sure you speak to those people back there.
We were talking about the whole thing about habits.
Well, I think of habit and addiction as being synonymous, but I think that that an addiction is a much more well-worn mental or neurological groove. And let's say, I have a habit of... when I wake up in the morning, the first thing that I do is, you know, I put my glasses over here. That kind of habit has less of an emotional sensate payoff than addiction does. And so the addiction as a habit is something that's deeply reinforced by the payoff that you get from it. Does that answer the question? Yes. Jennifer? It's a great question. Could you hear her back there? Yeah, okay. Well, my first reaction is to say that it seems to be quite idiosyncratic, meaning that if you listen to 100 people tell why they woke up, or whatever words you want to use, but let's just say for the sake of argument, woke up, you'll hear so many different stories. You know, so an example of a pattern or a theme is I saw the damage that it was doing to my family. You know, sometimes the reasons why people begin to wake up and choose move towards recovery is just simply their heart breaks when they realize the impact they're having on others. Another pattern that I think is common is that somebody who really cares about you is able to get inside your defenses and say the right thing. So an example for me is that when I was in my early 20s, a doctor said to me, you're going to have a heart attack by the time you're 30 if you keep this up. Well, he was neither a friend nor was he close enough to me. And what I heard was, oh, I got plenty of time. Anybody here can identify with that? Yeah. So it has to be somebody that, you know, that you trust and that they say it in a particular way. I actually have come to the point now where I really believe that developing some skill in meditation practice is a newfound way that many people are coming to recovery. You know, in the 12-step programs, meditation and prayer are step 11. So there's a premise in the 12 steps that it's an advanced practice. It's an advanced process. But what I'm noticing is that many more people, having been exposed to meditation, hearing the word, recognizing that it's reached mainstream, have dabbled with meditation at some time. They've done a relaxation, or somebody, you know, who is a teacher had them do some kind of visualization. And they remember that, and they get back to doing a little bit of it, and that by calming and settling, that they begin to actually know their mind and know what they're doing with more honesty. There was a hand over here. Yes, please.
Thank you, Elaine, for your sharing.
There definitely is. If you know Kevin Griffin, he wrote a book called One Breath at a Time. And he's a recovering person and also a Buddhist teacher. I recommend the book. And there is a movement now, Buddhism and recovery. It's beginning to really pick up some momentum. Mm-hmm. Yes, please, Marilee.
Can you say something about the American culture?
Well, I know one of the things that I found most disquieting recently is the UCLA study that demonstrated that children who watch any screen for more than 6 hours a day over a period of several years begin to lose some of their brain functioning that has to do with relational skills. Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, I think that that's part of the dilemma that, you know, I know I've been a member of several sanghas, and one of the kind of dilemmas about the structure and culture of a Buddhist practice is that it's not a 12-step program. You know, it's not a place where you come to talk about the dark side. But yet, all of us have dark places in our lives, and how do we relate to them? You know, do we relate to them with shame? You know, and feel somehow that we should be squeaky clean. You know, frankly, life is very messy, and human beings are crazy. And, you know, we're just nuts. So we have just a moment or two more. I'd like to offer one other epigram. So the flip side of you can never get enough of what you don't really need or want is enough is a feast. So just think about that for a moment. Enough is a feast. And so how do you know when something is enough? Well, one of the characteristics of enough is that there's a deep feeling of satisfaction. And you can't ever find satisfaction without having a settled mind. The mind is constantly dissatisfied. You know, if you just sit and you listen to the chatter inside your mind, it's a constant stream of I like, I don't like, I like, I don't like, I like, I don't like. And so the alternative to oscillating between this and that is being able to have such a well-developed observer that you're able to just watch the mind. Oh, it likes this. Oh, it doesn't like that. Oh, this is pleasant. Oh, this is unpleasant. You know, one doesn't have to go up and down and in and out with the mind's vicissitudes because it's just going to do what it's going to do. So I'd like to end by, first of all, thanking all of you for coming. I know many of you, this was the first time that you'd been to the Sangha, and maybe some of you, this was the first time that you'd sat quietly for 30 minutes at a stretch. That might have been a bit of a stretch for you, so I appreciate that. I'd like to acknowledge and honor the fact that this Sangha has many regular programs, and it makes an enormous difference in many people's lives, and I'd like to invite you back, and to especially when Shiloh's here after April 20th. Thank you.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.